time for us to end this hierarchy of who has the right to live, who deserves not to suffer.
As an indigenous person, the fur trade represents so much more to me than just animal abuse. It represents cultural genocide.
That is pretty summarized. There were 6 or 8 in the Reagan party.
Racist front. We would not know about
these kinds of actions are going to be more and more frequent.
Every laboratory we can help from information from inside the lab of someone who works there who took a drink of animals
strangely. They found the animals crippled and helpless, unable to use their arms and legs. No food or medical care. Broken bones. Fingers and toes torn off.
14 of the 2 dozen contestants are blocking the entrance to the
vet. That's why the objectionists say the animals have been taken to an undisclosed location out of state.
It's not possible to learn the truth, but our government is operating compensation camps for animals.
Good day, welcome to Animal Voices, your animal rights radio show on CIUT 89.5 FM and www.ciut.fm. I'm Rob Moore, talking today about raw food veganism and sports nutrition with guest Dr. Douglas Graham, kind of a superstar in the movement. He is an advisor to world-class athletes and trainers from around the globe, and has trained professional and Olympic athletes from almost every sport, including tennis legend Martina Navratilova, NBA player Ronnie Grandison, and the Norwegian national bicycling team. He has followed a raw vegan regimen for 25 years and has been vegetarian for over 30 years. Dr. Graham is also a founder and serves as president of Healthful Living International and is on the board of advisors of Earth Save International Organic Athlete and Voice for a Viable Future. He is also the author of several best-selling books, including Grain Damage, Nutrition and Athletic Performance, and the High Energy Diet Recipe Guide. Well, raw food must be working for this guy. The man doesn't stop. He's going to give us all the details on the raw food diet, including how it can enhance an athlete's performance. And really, in the sport and fitness worlds, veganism isn't widely accepted, let alone raw foodism. So I think we'll be introducing you to a new concept today, exploding some myths, how you can get all the nutrients and protein you need from raw food, and why, in Dr. Graham's opinion, eating whole, fresh, ripe, raw, organic food is the way to achieve vibrant health and vitality. I myself am a freelance fitness instructor working around the city, so I am very interested in hearing how a raw diet could help my energy levels when I'm teaching, you know, sometimes several hours a week. I've got lots of questions, and we'll also open up the lines later on to give our listeners a chance to call in and ask Dr. Graham your questions on nutrition, so stay tuned for that. But before we get to that, a note about athletics and nutrition. I attended the CanFit Pro conference on the weekend. CanFit Pro is Canada's largest organization of fitness professionals and one of the leading fitness training and certification bodies. And I was curious if there would be any talk of at least eliminating animal products from the diet. We've got several nutrition shows archived on our site, www.animalvoices.ca, with people like Dr. Michael Greger and Dr. Joel Furman, and recently the Super Size Me Detox Diet woman, Alex Jamieson, among others, all talking about how harmful animal products are to our bodies. And especially for fitness professionals, I would hope they would be leaders in nutrition. And you know what? They did host nutrition sessions on non-animal sources of protein. And I think that's progress. Maybe still far from touting raw foodism, but I think that definitely represents some headway. Mind you, the majority of attendees were carrying coffee cups to their early morning mind-body awareness classes, but whatever, baby steps, right? You can learn more about them at www.canfitpro.com. Well, let's waste no more time. We're going to go to a short musical break, and we'll come back with Dr. Graham. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Hello, welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Surviving some technical difficulties today, we're going to see if we have Dr. Graham on the line. Dr. Graham, are you there?
I am here right with you.
Hallelujah. Things do work out, don't they? The stars have aligned at 20 after 11. Welcome to Animal Voices. We're pretty excited to have you with us.
I'm actually excited to be here. I think I'm still here.
I think you're still here, too. He is coming through loud and clear. Is he tech? Excellent.
Great.
All right.
Looking forward to getting started.
Yeah, me too. Raw foodism and sports nutrition. First, can you define raw foodism for us?
Well, I can, but it's not up to me to decide or define who is a raw fooder. I have a definition, but it's certainly not the official one. Essentially, raw foodism is its own unique category where people decide to consume foods that are not heated or haven't been heated in any way before they're being consumed, and so that they are still technically nutritionally viable. This is an interesting category.
Sorry, Dr. Graham, can I just get you to speak up a little bit?
Yeah, this is an interesting category.
Thanks.
This idea of not heating the food. We've known for over 60 years that when foods are cooked, that nutrients are damaged, deranged, or destroyed. And people have decided that taking their health to the highest level by not consuming cooked food is really not a radical move at all, but actually a conservative one, that the radical move is the heating of food, even though we've, you know, it seems normal in society. There's a lot of things that we do that seem normal, even though they're really rather radical acts. And it's a different thing, raw foodism, than necessarily healthful living. And I make this differentiation clear and straightforward at the beginning, because is it raw, being a concept of whether or not to eat a food, is not enough, in my opinion.
But haven't people, I mean, we've been eating cooked food for thousands of years. Haven't we evolved to eat cooked food?
Actually, evolutionary changes typically take on the scale of 50,000 to 500,000 years or longer. And the 500,000 is a more common range than 100 or 200,000 years. Most of the people who study human history, anthropologists and the like, use the 10,000-year mark as a guess of when we've been cooking food, although some will say 20,000.
Hmm.
But we have a history for human beings and creatures like human beings walking the earth of over 20 million years. So for not even 1/100 of 1% of our entire history have we been doing any experiments with cooked food. It's, you know, in our evolutionary clock, as it were, it's not even 1 second out of a 24-hour day.
Right. Well, we'll get into the gritty details about raw foodism in a bit, but I'm curious to hear about your own journey to raw foodism.
Well, I started out as a sick child, and although I was an athlete child, for sure, I was a sick child. I wasn't going to pass kindergarten because I didn't attend enough days. They didn't want to let me go on, and I was extremely congested, and nobody knew why. And eventually doctors suggested at the age of 5 that my tonsils be removed, at which point I became a much more sick child than I was beforehand. And I never left the house without a container of tissues in my pocket, and allergy pills became a normal thing. And by the time I was 6, I was seeing an allergist and being treated weekly for 6 years with shots and having my sinuses vacuumed. If you've never had an experience until you've had a vacuum put up inside your sinus.
I hope never to have one like that.
you just don't know what's coming out, whether it's your sinuses or your brain.
Yeah.
It's not a good feeling. And boils and skin problems were just constant for me, and they were, it was never a fun time. I never thought of myself as sick per se. I just, you know, had my own little cross to bear, as it was.
It was your life.
And I equated my athleticism with my health, not realizing that the true status of my health was my weakest link, not my strongest link. You know, just like in a car. I mean, if it's a great car but it's got 4 flat tires, it's not really going anywhere. So you have to evaluate by the weakest link rather than the strongest one. And I started making dietary changes in my early teens in an effort not to improve my health, to be quite honest, but to improve my athletic performance. And I was involved in a lot of sports where body weight mattered, and carrying even a few extra pounds. I knew I was 165 and wanted to be more in the 150s. That those few extra pounds mattered, and I started looking around for how could I. So making dietary changes became a norm for me, and I experimented and experimented and experimented, and by college became a vegetarian, and not long after that, became a vegan. And the idea, you know, as a in grammar school, in high school, in college, I can remember the teachers that taught me that fruits and vegetables were health food and that they were the most nutritious of all foods. And finally, one day, the light went on, and I said, I wonder what would happen if I ate fruits and vegetables to the exclusion of everything else. And that didn't happen immediately. None of the transitions happened immediately. But eventually, the idea of not cooking and eating more fruits and vegetables started to join together. There were 6 people on the planet who were publicly speaking about raw food back then. And I contacted all of them and communicated with all of them. And basically all they were about was helping sick people get well through the use of raw food, which is a great thing. But it wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for athletic performance. I was a professional trampolinist making my living on the trampoline at the time and coaching others. And what I was looking for was world-class performance. So there was no model to follow, and I kept looking. I tried the various raw food models that existed. All of them either left me with lagging athletic performance or an inability to continue following the raw food. I would be driven back to cooked food. And so eventually, approximately 15 years ago, I developed my own model for eating raw food, which includes not only a complete alignment with the basic tenets of nutrition that are being taught worldwide today, but also left me feeling phenomenal and at the same time able to perform. So I found my health increased, my athletic performance increased, and my happiness increased right along with it. It all just kind of fell into place. Since I started doing that, I really haven't looked back, and the only thing that's developed is my vocabulary and terminology, my ability to explain to other people what it is that I'm doing.
And when you became a raw foodist or started incorporating more raw foods in your diet, you feel that enhanced your athletic performance?
Every step along the way, as I made dietary changes, it typically enhanced my performance. When I went vegetarian, I noticed various aspects of my muscular endurance improved. When I went vegan, my cardiorespiratory abilities definitely took a rise. As I went raw, various aspects of flexibility seemed to be enhanced. But it wasn't until I started following what I call my 80-10-10 diet that my overall athleticism just went through the roof, and all 5 aspects of athletic performance and every aspect of my health became literally untethered.
Yeah, no, I want to talk about your 80-10-10 diet in just a couple minutes. But I'm curious, actually, it sounds like your life echoes mine a little bit. I was sick a lot as a child, and when I became vegetarian and then vegan, I too found major changes in my athletic performance and just my energy levels. And so as a fitness instructor teaching several hours a week, I'm really curious to hear how raw food could help me achieve that next level. But, you know, there's so much out there against the raw food movement. There was an article in the Toronto Star recently in which they consulted experts that actually said it was dangerous. They said the raw food diet was dangerous because it didn't allow for the variety of foods that we need and the nutrients and, the B12 and the protein and that we need to supplement our diet with all kinds of vitamins and minerals if we're on this diet.
Well, it's interesting. The supplement question comes up quite often, and it's an all-day answer in many ways. I'll try to stay focused. If I boil it down to an essence, it would be that there is no model in nature for supplementation. There are no creatures who supplement their diet, nor do they show any need to when they consume the diet that is designed for them. There is good model in nature to demonstrate that the diet for which we are anatomically and physiologically designed is that of fruits and vegetables, as there is a long history in the teachings of medical science, that fruits and vegetables are health food, that they are our most nutritious food, that their nutritional content most closely mimics our nutritional needs. In a sentence, if we're eating healthfully, we should have no need for supplements. But if we're not eating healthfully, supplements will not make up for the lack any more than coffee and an alarm clock would make up for a lack of sleep. Or painting brown paint on your body would make up for a lack of sufficient sunlight. We have certain specific nutritional needs, and it's easy to recognize when these are being most well met. One of the best assessments of how well met our nutritional needs are is the ease with which our foods digest. That can be measured by the speed with which they digest. So, for instance, we understand when we breathe in air that it's in our bloodstream instantaneously. When we drink water, it's in our bloodstream in seconds. When we eat fruit, the nutrients from fruit are in our bloodstream actually from seconds to minutes. And with vegetables, also within minutes, the nutrients are in our bloodstream. And we've all had that experience when we were younger, perhaps, of eating foods that didn't sit so well, didn't digest so easily, and that 8 or 10 or 12 or even 24 hours later, we vomit back up that food. And it never passed our stomach. It took 12 hours and it was still in our stomach. It hadn't yet gotten to our bloodstream. So the difference between foods getting into the bloodstream rapidly and foods getting into the bloodstream extremely slowly represent not only how much work the body has to do to accomplish that feat, but also how well those foods mimic our nutritional needs. And this is a good assessment. I mean, if as an athlete, where would you rather put your energy, into digesting your food or into your physical performance?
Right. Is that why, you know, a lot of people who have a high meat diet, is that why they're tired a lot? Because they're so busy digesting all that meat?
Well, that's part of why they're tired. It is certainly a part of why they're tired. But we also have to look at what's called the caloronutrient ratio of every food that we eat, including our total overall diet. And I don't want to forget that variety question that you brought up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to look at the caloronutrient ratio. That is the amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrate in the food we eat or in our overall diet. We are designed, and it has been shown in countless studies, to require a specific caloronutrient ratio in order for us to, as it were, fire on all cylinders, in order to meet our full potential. And the fuel portion of that caloronutrient ratio is the carbohydrate. We know that every cell of the human body is designed to be fueled by carbohydrate. In fact, specific carbohydrates called glucose and fructose. And meat has one of the lowest carbohydrate contents of any food we could eat. Therefore, although it's got plenty of fat and plenty of protein, it's sort of like saying my car has a great battery and the tires are good, but there's no fuel in the tank. Without fuel in the tank, it's very tough to have much go power. You may have other things going for you really well by, you know, consuming that particular food. But if it doesn't give you fuel, I mean, you're just sitting there waiting to go with no fuel in your tank. And it's hard to go, and it feels like you're, in fact, in endurance sports and ultra-endurance sports, there's a phenomenon called hitting the wall, at which point runners and other athletes describe a sensation of feeling as if they're running through jello or running through a thick fog. It becomes running uphill continuously when they're not. And the effort level, the perceived effort level goes up dramatically. And that's because the athlete has run out of available carbohydrates. The glycogen that's in their muscles and the blood sugar that they use to fuel their muscles. And at that point, they have to convert fat to fuel, and it takes tremendous effort.
So
when we're consuming a diet that's tremendously high in fat, we're doing the same thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see, for instance, diabetics who are put on a low-carbohydrate diet tend to be low-energy people.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with people who are trying to consume a low-carbohydrate diet.
Well, now that Atkins is bankrupt, let's hope that, you know, people wake up about that.
It'll come.
Yeah, I think so. So talk about what you eat then. Let's talk about what raw food is eat. Or not just raw food is, what you recommend raw food is
eat. Well, it's interesting. You know, the in this what we would call the standard westernized diet, has a caloronutrient ratio, and I use that concept often because it's not the only thing in nutrition, but it's one of the bigger categories. Before we start micromanaging our nutrition, you've got to worry about the big thing. And where your protein, carbs, and fat come from is one of the biggest things. Before we start worrying about the micronutrients, the biggest macronutrients certainly have to be considered first. Everything else tends to fall in line if we handle the big concepts before we deal with the little ones. And so, for myself, I mean, my diet is comprised of fruits and vegetables. It's a very simple diet. Do I include other things? Sure, I include the occasional nut or a little bit of seed. But I eat a diet that's composed of whole, fresh, ripe, or organic plants. That's what I eat. And it, yes, indeed, it was an evolution. And yes, it took some adapting, both physically, mentally, emotionally, even learning the mechanics of how to secure my food and make sure it ripened, you know, in a viable state for me so I always have what I need. But it's just part of the learning curve. It wasn't difficult. What was difficult was being sick all the time. What was difficult was looking forward to a life that was going to be like everybody else's, where I suffered a great portion of my life and spent the last 30 years going out in parts. It was difficult to think of missing, as an average American does, 2 to 3 weeks of work per year, which is only average. When I know now that, you know, when I look back and say that I haven't had one sick day since December 16, 1980.
Really?
That was my last sick day, and I remember it vividly, and I'm not looking forward to another sick day. Thank you very much.
So you haven't had, like, a head cold or anything like that?
No, nothing. It's just incredible to wake up and feel that good. Like my baby does every morning, just wake up and a big smile comes on her face, and I just go, yay, I get another day, and I feel phenomenal, and there's no shackles holding me back from doing whatever I want today. No considerations of my physical being telling me that I can't do what I want to do.
And that's pretty incredible, but I think you need to illustrate a little bit more what a day in the life of you is in terms of the diet.
I can tell you that as a child, almost every picture of me was of me standing at the refrigerator door with the door open, looking in, trying to decide what to eat next. That I ate one meal a day, and the only time I stopped snacking was to sit down and eat a meal. So it was just one long snack.
Okay.
And I was never satiated. I was always hungry. I was always looking, and it took a long time before I realized that the reason I was always hungry wasn't for lack of calories, but it was for lack of nutrients. I was looking around for nutrients. And as I improved my diet over the years, I kept finding that the food was more satiating than it used to be, that I got less hungry in between meals. And when I finally went to the diet that I'm now following, for the first time in my life, I was freed because I no longer was looking around for food except when it became mealtime. I don't think about food. I'm not constantly focused on food. I'm not worrying about the next meal or creating it in my head long before it's time to eat it. Essentially, nowadays, when I'm in a period of time where I'm what I would call my normal life, I eat two meals a day. I eat a lunchtime meal and a dinnertime meal, and that's the end of it. When I'm in a opportunity time of life where I get to play more or do more physical activities than is my norm, which I enjoy tremendously, those opportunities, then I typically eat three meals a day.
And what do those meals consist of?
And that's where we're going.
Is it like two heads of lettuce? Is it?
Actually, I can give fairly simple averages, but I have to make it clear that because Mother Nature provides us our food in an ever-changing array based on the season, my diet is actually more varied than anyone I've ever met, and I'll put the variety of my diet against that of anyone, because typically in the course of a year, I'm consuming about 200 different fruits, about 50 different vegetables, tasting at least 25 to 50 different nuts and seeds and fatty foods of that type. And so I mean, to eat approximately 300 different foods in 365 days is pretty astonishing. When most people have a hamburger or pizza or chicken almost every single day. So when they say, when people talk about variety, no one can match the variety that's provided by nature in terms of fruits and vegetables. It's when we go to prepare foods that we lose all our variety. For myself, I eat very simply because I've found that not only do I prefer it, but my body prefers it. And at some point, I had to develop a relationship. I had to come to terms with the fact that I was in a relationship with my food that I couldn't escape from. But I did have a choice of the nature of that relationship. Did I want to be in a relationship with foods that loved me as much as I love them? Or did I want to be in a relationship with foods that I love, but every time I took part in them, they hurt me? And I have the choice to do so. So I chose foods that love me back. And I still love them just as much. And I promise you that when I sit down to a meal of mango, I certainly love it just as much as a meal of cheeseburger. And it's not that I didn't love my cheeseburger. I know people are out there loving their cheeseburgers. But the cheeseburgers are hurting them in return. And it's been proved on every scientific level. It's been proved on their own level when we know that both prescription and over-the-counter remedies for indigestion are the number one selling drugs in their categories. It's the number one reason people go to doctors is because they're having indigestion.
And constipation, so, yeah.
So it's just a fascinating thing that, for myself, I've chosen to go with simple meals, which means fewer varieties of food at any given meal. More variety in my overall diet, but in nature, if we use that as our model, creatures eat one food at a time when they're hungry until they're full. Unless they're chased off their food or they run out, they're going to eat until they're satiated of what there is. And so if I go out to a cherry tree, I feel perfectly comfortable to make a meal of cherries. When it's mango season, or when the bananas come ripe, or when figs are finally in, I'm going to eat the food that is available. And I have found through experience that mono meals are the easiest to digest. And so I like the way my body feels. And it wasn't, I'll be honest with the listeners, it wasn't what I wanted to do when I first heard and discovered this concept of one food at a time when I was hungry until I was full. I balked. I dug in my heels and said, I don't want to go there, but I'll experiment with it and see what it's like. And I did, and I tried it, and it just kept working better than anything else. It left me more satiated and more able to control my weight, and I eventually learned that literally people are addicted to the stimulation of variety. And so a person can say, they can push back their chair and say, I'm stuffed, I can't eat another bite. But when the waitress comes over and says, would you like dessert? They go, ah, the stimulation of variety, yes. I could eat something else, as long as it's not the same thing. And we tend to overeat in this fashion. It doesn't support health or performance in any way.
So is a mono meal just a meal of one food?
Sure, it's a meal of one food.
When you say you sat down to a meal of mangoes, is mangoes your whole meal?
It's my entire meal.
Really? And how can you get, or do you need the whole balance of, say, amino acids and, you know, your proteins from that one meal? Do you need to get it at one meal, or can you get it throughout the day?
Well, in fact, no, you don't need it at any one meal. Your body maintains a pool of amino acids. 75% of the proteins within our body are made up of that floating pool of available amino acids, where only 25% of the proteins in our body are structurally stable. 75% are actually labile. They're available to be used as needed. And so the body can pick and choose and pull what it needs. It's interesting, though, because it's really a backwards way of looking at the world. I'm eating fruits and vegetables, which everyone will agree are the most nutritious food, the healthiest food. And people wonder, where do I get my nutrients? When I simplify my diet down to fruits and vegetables, we should be wondering where our next-door neighbors are getting their nutrients, because they're eating bottled, boxed, canned, frozen, dehydrated, cooked foods, denatured, demineralized, changed in every way from what may have once been nutritious food. I mean, people don't know how... I mean, when they're eating a hamburger, they don't know when that animal died. It died a long, long time ago. If people stop to think about it, and they ask me, where do I get my nutrients? I'm not up on a high horse. I'm really not. But the ludicrous thing is that simply because it's different than everybody else, people start to think that it's insufficient. When in reality, most of the diseases today are diseases of excess, too much fat, too much protein, too much food. And here I am eating the food we're designed for, recommending that we eat more fruits and vegetables. And people wonder, well, is that nutritious enough? It's kind of funny, isn't it? But I will tell you, I have done the science behind it. And yes, in fact, we do meet our nutrient needs more fully on a diet of fruits and vegetables than we do on any other diet. And I've got the science behind it to prove it. I've written the book and now a second book called Prevention and Care of Athletic Injuries, where almost half of that book deals with the nutrition behind healing from athletic injuries and how fruits and vegetables best serve in that category as well. And in fact, the mainstream nutritionists, when we look at their recommendations, the 80-10-10 approach actually fits into their recommendations as well. The 80-10-10 raw vegan approach fits it even more closely.
Tell us about your 80-10-10 diet.
It's funny because I never, ever thought in a million years that I would come up with something that I would attach in some way either to me or my name. And I'm still not looking to do that. This is nature's plan. But in order to describe it in a simple way, I use the 80-10-10 as its name. And it's simply this. Nutritionists have proven to us that 10% of our total calories from protein are sufficient. Are more than sufficient, in fact. The average American eats 11% of their total calories from protein. All the way across the northern hemisphere, we eat approximately 11% of our total calories from protein. To recommend 10 is not an outrageous concept because it really fits in with what we're doing right now. I don't care whether it's 10 or 11, but the World Health Organization, our government, and everyone else has told us that they're recommending that number because it provides such a huge safety margin between what we really need and what we're consuming. And so most studies on humans have said that 5% is enough, but that 10% gives you a huge safety margin, a net, through which you never need worry about insufficiency. And so I start out with a maximum of 10% of calories from protein. Interestingly, the range of protein in most fruits is between 4 and 12. Most fruits carry a protein content between 4 and 12% of their total calories. If we go back to our very basic science from grammar school biology, remember that every cell has a nucleus, and the nucleus carries the genetic material, that old Crick and Watson double helix, of DNA, and that DNA is made up of amino acids. And so there's protein in every cell of everything alive. Yes, there's protein in watermelon and mangoes and bananas and lettuce. And when we eat it, we access those amino acids. And the average protein content of fruit is somewhere between 6 and 7%, which is exactly where our government and our nutritionists and everyone else around the world is telling us is more than sufficient protein, approaching 10%.
And then the other 10% is fat.
Well, the other 10% is fat. And it's interesting because the largest study ever done on human beings, the China study, has come up. T. Colin Campbell, one of the most respected researchers in the world, has recommended that the lower our fat consumption, the better it is. As it approaches single digits, we hit all-time health performance levels, and that when it goes anywhere beyond mid-teens, measurable and monitorable, noticeable signs and symptoms of decline in health are easy to demonstrate. And in fact, the higher the fat content in the overall diet, the lower the overall health of the population consuming it. From McDougal to Ornish to Harris to Heidrick to Clappert, everyone is recommending a single digit up to 10% fat content in our overall diet. It's a rather fascinating thing. I'm not suggesting anything unusual. What I'm suggesting is a diet that makes it possible, because we've been recommending lower our fat consumption for over 40 years. But in the last 40 years, we haven't dropped our fat consumption even a total of 1%. It's gone down about 0.7 of 1%. And so we're not going in a direction, or certainly not at a speed, that will ever get us there. We won't get down to healthy health levels for over 4,000 years at the speed that we're going now. And that's too little too late. Nobody's going to live that long. So, in fact, Udo Erasmus, who sells fat for a living, Udo's oil, recommends 15% of total calories from fat. It's not an out of the ordinary question or recommendation, and it's fascinating once again because the average fruits and vegetables, if we combine fruits and vegetables and make an entire meal in an entire day and supply all of our calorie needs from fruits and vegetables, we're probably going to be eating a diet that's around 6 or 7% of total calories from fat. All of the essential amino acid needs are met. In fact, it becomes difficult to meet amino acid or essential fatty acid needs only when we cook our food. When the foods are in their raw state, both the essential fatty acids and the amino acids are readily available. And so what 80-10-10 is actually about is simply a diet that is structured to provide a maximum of 10% calories from protein, a maximum of 10% calories from fat, and a minimum of 80% calories from carbohydrates. And then we just start to define which type of carbohydrates, and we get into a little fine-tuning.
Right. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you a few questions we got from one of our listeners.
I'll give short answers.
About the 80-10-10 diet. This caller said, what are your food recommendations for a diabetic person wishing to follow your 80-10-10 raw vegan lifestyle? For example, should he or she avoid certain sweet fruit or limit the amount
of
sweet fruit?
Actually, the dietary considerations don't vary from human to human, but getting to be able to enjoy them varies a bit. In other words, we're taking a tightrope walk from A to B. Humans are coming into dietary change from various compromised health situations, need to be guided on an individual basis. I'm a doctor, yes, I'm retired, but I respect the fact that I need to take a history and need to guide each individual as an individual because there are individual considerations. Typically what I do for a diabetic is put them in a diet where they eat no overt fats for several days before we start introducing any fats. It's the fats in the diet. Since 1959, Journal of American Medical Association demonstrated that it was the fat in our diet, not the sugar in our diet, that results in the symptoms called diabetes. This has been reproved again and again and again in the last coming up to 50 years now. And it is not news that it is fat, not sugar, that results in diabetes. Fat levels over 10% inhibit the uptake, transport, and delivery of sugar to the muscles. And that is exactly the problem. We get sugar in our blood and can't get it out. The insulin becomes ineffective due to the presence of fat, which is what we call insulin-resistant diabetes.
And another question, what are your recommendations to cope with the cold weather for a person wishing to follow this lifestyle? And, and that includes, for us northerners, how can we eat, you know, local and raw and organic? And
well, local
that?
Becomes a problem the further you get from the locale where the food is produced. Fortunately, in Canada, you have a huge advantage in terms of your import laws, and I can get some of the best produce that I've ever gotten in Toronto and Vancouver and Montreal. It's amazing. I get more tropical fruit there than I can in Atlanta or New York. You guys do far better in that regard. But in terms of dealing with the heat, it's a very simple thing. And the answer is, in many ways, obvious. People don't stop eating hot food in hot weather. And heat isn't really the issue. We're talking about human beings that weigh between 100 and 200 pounds, and they're eating food that's 10 degrees warmer than them, a couple of ounces of it. That's not what gets you warm. What gets you warm is the tropical environment in which you surround yourself, your clothing, the heating of your home, your bedding, and your physical activities. In fact, physical activity is the best way to warm up that there is. We live in a sedentary world full of people who have become so sedentary that they're not even capable of performing physical fitness activities at a level that we would consider to be moderate for a fit individual. I have heard, for instance, that in the 911 disaster, part of the problem of getting people out of the building was that many of them using the stairs didn't have the fitness level to walk down several flights of stairs. And so they were incapacitated on the steps themselves. It's a sorry state. We've learned to accept the level of fitness as being normal that is would have been, even 50 years ago, considered a debilitated person. Today, we consider this as a normal level of activity. I mean, anybody ever tried to steer a car lately without having power steering? We used to think that was normal.
Indeed. I'll have to ask you one more question before we leave. When will your 80-10-10 book be available in Canada?
I'm hopeful. I'm really seriously hopeful that it's going to be out in the spring. It got bogged down in some editing challenges where we're putting a tremendous amount more footnotes in than what we had initially started with in order to give people literally nowhere to turn in terms of saying, yes, but, yeah, but. And just trying to show the documentation, and that just took a little longer than we anticipated. The book is finished, and it's simply a matter of the editors doing their part now.
Well, we didn't even get to a lot of things that I wanted to get to, including the environment and how exactly raw food can enhance your athletic potential.
Rob, I look forward to coming back.
Yeah, will you be back in just a couple of weeks, actually?
I'm looking forward to it immensely.
Great.
Anybody who wants to know more about the program that I follow, I have a huge FAQ on my website. I mean, it's extensive reading on my website, and it's all for free. And they can go to my Food and Sport, FOODNSPORT, foodandsport.com website, and read to their heart's desire. I run seminars teaching this program all over the world. And we run a program called Health and Fitness Week every September. This year it's the 11th to the 18th.
Great.
And people who want there's going to be athletes at every level there, from people who are literally infirm but they want to get fit, all the way up to world-class performers.
Great. And if people didn't get that information, they can check us out on www.animalvoices.ca.
Right.
Dr. Graham, thanks for being with us.
It's totally my pleasure. Thanks for having me and being so supportive.
Great, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Stay tuned for Roadrunner.